two films, one theme. This is Words in Movies.
Thank you once again, Rebecca, and welcome to yet another episode of Words in Movies. I'm your co-host, Claude Call.
And I'm your other co-host, Sean Gallagher. And we're continuing our series of movies from around the world. And today's episode, we're calling Wedding Blues, because both the movies we're talking about today not only concern weddings, but the word wedding is in the title. From India, from 2001, though it was released in the U.S. in 2002, Monsoon Wedding, directed by Mira Nair. And from Denmark, from 2007, After the Wedding, directed and co-written by Suzanne Beer. And in addition to the similar titles and the similar events, both movies are directed by women directors, although the main characters in both movies are men, even though they're both somewhat ensemble pieces. And both movies involve major revelations that happen, although they happen at different times in the movies. So, of course, spoilers abound. So, with the end, finally, both movies were made in a somewhat similar style. And we'll get to that as we get deeper into the discussion. But for now, Claude is going to give us the plot description for Monsoon Wedding, exactly and approximately.
You've kind of anticipated me here. We are pretty much thrown into the deep end of the pool as we enter into the days before a large, elaborate wedding in India. It's not just immediate family, but extended family, and they're coming from literally all over the world to attend the ceremony. People are arriving, and there are lots of introductions, but it's very tough at first to follow who's who and who's related to who else, but that's not remarkably different from any person who arrives at a huge event, right? So, fortunately, you've got me to help you out. So, Lalit and Pimi are the parents of Aditi and her adolescent brother, Varun. They've set up an arranged marriage for Aditi to Hemant, the son of a family friend who lives in Texas. The soon-to-be married couple has only known each other for a couple of weeks, but there's an extra complication for Aditi in that she's still a little hung up on her boss, Vikram, with whom she's had an affair until she realized that he was never going to leave his wife. Lalit and Pimi are getting some help with the planning from Pimi's sister, Shashi, and her husband, C.L. They've hired a professional named P.K. Dubey to take care of setting up the various elements of the ceremony. Dubey is generally good at what he does, even if he has an eccentric way of going about it. Dubey also has a habit of eating some of the thousands of marigolds that they're hanging around the yard for the ceremony. We meet Tej Puri, who's usually referred to here as Tej Uncle. He's married to Lalit's sister, and it's not completely spelled out, but he basically helped keep Lalit's family afloat financially when they took a big hit after India's border lines were redrawn to create Pakistan and eventually Bangladesh. And finally, there's a 10-year-old relative named Ayelia, whose relationship to the others isn't quite clear to me. She's a bright young lady. She seems kind of wise beyond her years, and we learn why later on. During one scene, we meet with Aditi's cousin Rhea and her mother, who live with Lali and his family, Lalit, since Rhea's father died many years ago. There's a conversation where we learn that Rhea aspires to be a writer and wants to go to school in America, and Tej offers to pay for her to attend school in the U.S. Everybody thinks this is wonderful, but Rhea looks a little uncomfortable. As we get closer to the big day, Lalit is having a tough time affording everything. For instance, it turns out that he hasn't paid for Dubey to ensure that the wedding tent is waterproofed, and that's going to cost a bundle. He's embarrassed to have to borrow the money from some friends and work colleagues, but they all appear to be understanding about the cost involved with marrying off your daughter. Meanwhile, Dubey finds himself smitten with Alice, the maid. He frequently finds himself stopping whatever he's doing to look at Alice whenever she goes by. At one point, he spies on her trying on jewelry for the wedding, and when some of the other workers see her, they accuse her of stealing. As a result, she tries her best to stay far, far away from Dubey. Varun, the younger brother, has been practicing a dance with another cousin named Aisha. At one point during the practice, Rahul, a nephew of Pimi's from Australia, who Lalit doesn't respect, walks into the room and Aisha begins dancing with him instead, clearly flirting with him. Varun gets frustrated and gives up on the dance practice for the time being. Lalit thinks that between the dancing and Varun's aspirations to become a chef, he might be becoming effeminate and may have to attend a boarding school. Rhea spots Aelia eating samosas and discovers that Tej is in there with her. Aelia explains that the samosas were too high up on the shelf for her to reach. Late at night, Aisha is secretly going to meet with Rahul. Pimi and Lalit are doing a walkthrough of the house to make sure that everyone's okay before they go to bed, and Aisha has to duck down behind a piece of furniture. Rahul covers for her, and Pimi and Lalit leave. Aisha and Rahul give each other a couple of minutes of intimate chat before she leaves. Aditi sneaks out of the house and meets with Vikram, and they have sex in the back of his car. They're caught by a couple of cops, and Vikram gives them a hard time. Aditi takes the opportunity to drive away, leaving Vikram stranded in the rain. Lalit and Pimi have a conversation during which they talk about sending Varun to the boarding school. He comes into the room and they broach the topic with him, and he's furious, so much so, in fact, that he says he won't be dancing with Aisha at the upcoming festivities. When Aisha finds out, she tries to convince Rahul to dance with her instead, reasoning, well, he knows most of the dance already and he can just fake the rest, but he's resistant to the idea, and that really irritates her. When he tells someone that as a result of this conversation, he may have fallen from grace, he's reminded that you have to stand up first before you can fall, and it's food for thought for Rahul. Aditi and Hemant go to a chai shop to spend some time together, and she confesses her indiscretion to him. And while the event cemented why she left him in the first place, she didn't want there to be any secrets between them. Hemant is naturally very upset, but ultimately thinks that, look, if she's willing to try, he's willing to do so as well. And he expresses confidence that they can put it behind them and make it work out. We get a scene in which Doobie's workers intercept Alice en masse and apologize to her for what they did, and shortly after that, Alice walks into an elaborate display arranged by Doobie in which he confesses his feelings. The night before the wedding, there's a big party. Aisha dances by herself, but Rahul eventually joins her in what's probably the most typical Bollywood scene of the film. Before long, everyone is on their feet. Aditi and Hemant steal away from the group, and they share a few intimate moments together, and it's looking good for our young couple. Meanwhile, Aelia begins complaining that she's tired and wants to go to bed. Tej offers to take her out for ice cream instead, and he puts her in his car. When Rhea finds out they're leaving, she runs out after the car with Lalit and Pimi among others, behind her. Rhea intercepts the car and pulls Aelia out, confronting Tej with the fact that he molested her when she was Aelia's age. Lalit's sister, who you'll remember is Tej's wife, doesn't believe Rhea and accuses her of being bad character and unmarried besides. Oh, the horror. Rhea leaves the house. That night, Lalit has a series of flashbacks and suddenly puts the pieces together. Rhea wasn't lying, and now he feels responsible for not protecting her. Distraught, he turns to Pimi for comfort. The next morning, Lalit goes to Rhea and begs her to come back. He tells her that he can't imagine what she went through, and as the man who raised her as his own, he feels responsible, but because Tej is family and has done so much for them, he can't disown him. However, he does get her to agree to return for Aditi's sake. Only a few hours before the wedding, Lalit has a change of heart and asks Tej and his sister to leave. He doesn't want to say any more because of the crowd of people, but if necessary, he will. His sister tries again to minimize Rhea's accusations, but Lalit isn't having it, and the couple leaves. The rains begin as we see Aditi and Hemant's elaborate wedding. We also see Doobie and Alice getting married in a much simpler ceremony in some parallel action, and later on, they join the larger event as a married couple. And during the closing credits, we are treated to several short scenes from the wedding ceremony, and one of the last credits we see is a nod to a phrase we've heard a couple of times in the film. We are like that. Only 40 locations, 30 days, exactly and approximately.
So, let's talk about Mira Nair.
Let's do.
The director of the movie. She was born and raised in India, although she attended school in Harvard and also worked on documentaries in New York City as well as India before making her feature film debut with the 1988 drama Salaam Bombay. Now, unfortunately, this movie is not available for streaming anywhere, You have to see if Amazon, eBay, or perchance your local library has it. But it's very much in the neorealist tradition of filmmakers like De Sica, also following the footsteps of another film about small children in slums in a non-English language speaking country that had come out earlier that decade, Peixote from Brazil, directed by Hector Babenca, which is one of the most devastating movies ever made. And if memory serves, while Salaam Bombay isn't quite that bleak, it's still pretty hard-hitting. And Nair followed that up with her English language feature film debut, Mississippi Masala. And I'm going to come back to the term masala in just a moment. But it's a romantic drama about an Indian family that was forced to flee from Uganda during Idi Amin's reign there. And they've settled in Mississippi, where they own a motel. And the daughter of the family falls in love with an African-American who runs his own cleaning business, who's played by Denzel Washington. And that movie juggled a lot of things together: history, romance, and family drama. And for the most part, it juggled them pretty well. And it wasn't hurt by the fact that Sarita Chaudhary, who plays the daughter, and Washington had terrific chemistry together. But after that, Nair stumbled. Her next movie, The Perez Family, was a movie about, loosely based on a group of Cuban refugees who came to Florida in 1981 during the Mariel boat lift. And although Nair complained that the studio took the movie away from her in the editing room, it also wasn't helped by casting Alfred Molina, Marissa Tomei, and Angelica Houston as some of those Cuban refugees. Yeah.
Oh,
and
no.
Then Nair went back to India to make a movie called Kama Sutra, which, of course, is inspired by the well-known book Kama Sutra, The Art of Love. Unfortunately, at least the last time I saw it, I don't remember it being sexy or compelling at all. And so I was, at that point, ready to write Nair off.
You say you're being kind of harsh here.
Wedding, yeah, but Monsoon, she did make one other movie during this time, an AIDS-related drama, which is supposedly pretty good, which I have not seen. But Monsoon Wedding was her comeback movie. It got nominated for a BAFTA award, won a British Independent Film Award for Best Foreign Language Film, was nominated for that same prize at the Golden Globes that year, was nominated for a few People's Choice Awards in India, and then also won the top prize at the Venice Film Festival in 2001, which is called the Golden Line. And the Venice Film Festival, by the way, even though it is not quite at the high level maybe of the Cannes Film Festival, it's still considered an important festival, and a lot of good films have played there in the past. And so I was persuaded to see this in the theater, and I thought it was a great comeback film for Nair, being a really good movie as well as being a comeback. Were you taken in by the movie, Claude?
I absolutely was. You know, and Like I said early on in my description there, at first you've got just like hundreds of people going in and you're getting some exposition because people are being introduced to other people. And so you're getting the names, but you're not necessarily locking them in. But that's kind of okay because, as I said, that's what happens when you go to events like this. You kind of hear the names and you have to pick them all up later on as you get a little bit deeper into the event that you're attending. So, you know, that wasn't necessarily a bad thing. I kind of took it from where it was. You get, you know, some interesting views of some of the people there. And I think we're going to see some of this in After the Wedding too. And basically those views change as the story progresses. It's not like in most cases, you know, you have like a character who's one way and then there's a big reveal and they're another way. You know, for the most part, like you're looking at, let's say, Doobie, and you're saying, wow, this is a weird guy with the eating the flowers, and you think he's a little bit of a con man, but it turns out he's actually pretty competent. And then, you know, the thing where he's, you know, taken with Alice, who, and the first time he sees her, she's basically shattered a tray of glasses at his feet. And so she's, you know, being all kinds of clumsy and whatever else, and he doesn't care. So you warm up to the every character, no matter how bad or weird or unpleasant you think they are. And then similarly with Tej Uncle, early in the film, not very early, but you get the sense that there's something not quite right, maybe a little bit weird or greasy about him. And sure enough, as you get deeper into the film, your suspicions are confirmed. But it's nice to see that basically everybody seems to evolve a little bit as you move from one end of this film to the other. Nobody stays like, you know, he's the hero, he's the villain. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. And while, as I mentioned, I am going to get to the Indian influences on the movie in just a moment, what I detected here as well, which is in the spirit of what you were just talking about, are influences of a filmmaker whom we've already talked about, Altman, mm-hmm. because Nashville and Shortcuts are sort of the same way, in that people who you think you've got pegged turn out to be a little different than maybe you thought at the beginning. And I also detect the spirit of Jean Renoir, the great French filmmaker whose best movie, The Rules of the Game, mm-hmm. is sort of a touchstone or template, I should say, for this kind of ensemble comedy drama piece where everything may seem light on the surface, but then you get some revelations going on that change your views of everything that's happening. And in that movie, there is one character who is actually played by Renoir, who says at one point, the awful thing about life is this: everybody has their reasons. And that's sort of the guiding spirit in the Altman movies that we discussed, and also in this movie. Now, no matter who we're talking about here, whether it's PK or Tej Uncle or even the Lalit and Pimmy and Aditi and Hemant, you know, they all have their reasons. Mm-hmm. And Nair and Sabrina Dewan, who, by the way, was Nair's student at Columbia University. She was a student there. And I think Nair was a professor there when she was a student. And she wrote the movie as a first draft while she was at Columbia. They seem to go by that principle throughout the entire movie. And I think that's one of the reasons why it works so well.
Yeah, I think so. It's just, I don't know, this film, It really was a lot of fun. And you know, the other thing that kind of that struck me as kind of amusing is, you know me and my habit of like watching these films with the captions on just to see what's going on and where seeing things change from time to time. And this was a film that, you know, there are people who basically they keep switching languages, and there's a lot of the film is in English, but there are times when people do like the it's like the Hindu version of Spanglish, where they keep slipping in and out of English as they're speaking. And so, you know, you kind of benefit from having captions anyway, because just the way that everybody's speaking very quickly, very heavily accented, and not always in English, as I say, they just keep jumping back and forth and you have a tough time following.
There's regular Hindu too as well.
Yeah. There are sentences in Hindu, but there's also times when people just keep jumping back and forth, and it's kind of interesting and fun to listen to. I guess because when I lived in New York, I had a lot of exposure to Spanglish, and I never heard any of the language kind of jump back and forth like that. So that was kind of interesting and as I say, fun to do. I get the influences that you're talking about. Now, I don't necessarily know if Nair is a student of Altman or Renoir, but I do get that, you know, yeah, we get a lot of the overlapping dialogue, but whatever needs to be heard definitely does get heard and manages to advance the story as it should. But the big difference in this case being that this is probably a little bit more tightly scripted than a typical Altman film.
Actually, no.
Really?
Because according to an interview I have that Nair did on the Criterion Edition movie that I have, she did allow for a lot of improvisations when they were rehearsing it and when they were shooting it. And then also, they did have to reshoot part of it because the film was damaged when it was going through an airport X-ray machine. So they had to reshoot a lot of the scenes, including a scene between Aditi and Hemant when they're sort of getting to know each other after she tells him about her affair. And Nair said that I think in almost every case, the reshoots ended up being better. But also, as far as the improvisations go, there's a morning scene between Lalit and Pimmy. By the way, Lalit is played by Nasiruddin Shah, and Pimmy is played by Lalit Dubey. And they have an argument. And originally, it was written as a really loud, really angry argument. But the two actors and Nair, when they were rehearsing it, decided that no, this would be better if it's just old folks married argument that mm-hmm. they seem to have all the time. So, you know, they're sniping at each other, but they're not really drawing blood.
No, they're just sticking to the script, so to really.
Yeah. So,
as you know, historical couple that way, yeah.
Yes. So that when Pimmy gets upset about the way that Lalit is acting towards their son, and then later, when Lalit finds out the truth about Tej, and he's so overcome by that he is crying in bed, and mm-hmm. Pimmy is so moved by this that she hugs him close. That scene, I think, wouldn't have been as moving if the arguments that they had been a real angry argument, because I don't know if I would have necessarily believed it. Whereas here, it works.
I got to agree with you. That is a genuinely moving scene, you know, and not just because, you know, he's suddenly having this revelation and understanding, like, oh my gosh, like I had this responsibility. I failed at this responsibility. I don't even know what to say. I don't know what to do. And he's freaking out. And so he turns to her and they embrace for a little bit. And then the other thing at the very end of the scene, they basically spoon up, right? She turns around and gets in close to spoon up. And she reaches behind her to take his hand and pull it over her. And that's like the last thing we see in that shot. And I'm like, that is really sweet. I was loving that scene. Even as terrible as I was feeling for these characters, I mean, I was like, this is just wonderful.
Yes. And we should mention that Aditi is played by Vasundhara Das, and Hemant is played by Parvin Dabas. Now, a lot of the actors that you see in here are actually non-actors. Nair wanted to have more professional actors in the movie, but because of scheduling and funding reasons, most of the professionals had to drop out. So she ended up casting a lot of non-actors. The person who plays Tej, Rajat Kapoor, for example, is a non-actor. I think Nair said that he was, I forgot what she said, but anyway, he was not involved in acting at all. And speaking of Kapoor, Nair said that she wanted to avoid casting someone who looked like an obvious villain and wanted to make him a good-looking guy. And that's why she cast Kapoor in the role. Now, the one actor who I know is a major professional who has done work that's been seen outside of India is an actor who has some of the smallest screen time in the movie, and that's the guy who plays Hemant's father, Roshan Seth. He played the father figure in Mississippi Masala, and he's been in a bunch of other movies as well. He was in Gandhi. He was in my least favorite of the Indiana Jones movies, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Okay. Yes. And also, he was in a very good BBC miniseries that you should check out if you could find it, called The Buddha of Suburbia from 1993. And he's also in David Lean's last movie, A Passage to India. So he's been in a lot of stuff, but because of scheduling issues and funding issues, he was only in the movie for 2 days of shooting. But the rest of the cast is mostly non-actors, and that includes the gentleman who plays PK, who, as you say, you know, turns out to be one of the most compelling characters in the movie. And he's played by Vijay Raz. He swears up a storm throughout a lot of the movie.
Yes, he does.
And yet his courtship of Alice, who's played by Tilotama Shome, is very chaste and touching as a result. And that's one of the reasons why it works so well, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's very little in the way of actual courtship, at least that we see. There's a lot of him just kind of, you know, worshiping from afar. He's just like, every time she goes by, he stops what he's doing and he stares at her, and he's got these thick glasses on, so he looks a little bit weird too. Not every time, but mostly. And then and then it's not until the really close to the end where the workers, you know, go up and they just kind of descend upon Alice and they apologize to her, and she walks a little bit further and she sees this big elaborate display that he has put together for her, and you know, that's where the courtship as such begins. So we see very little actual courtship going on, but that's okay. But you're right. It's kind of a chaste sort of thing. And even when he is watching her with the jewelry, you know, it's not meant to be this lascivious, let me see if she takes her clothes off kind of thing. It's like he's enjoying her image in the mirror as she's trying on the jewelry and looking at herself and trying on, she put on like a couple of different headscarves and it discarded that one and put it away, that kind of thing. And so he's really upset when the workers all collect around him and then they say, oh, she's stealing. And then she suddenly realizes she's being watched. Cause at first there was a brief moment where I thought she knew he was watching. And I had to go back again and look and say, no, that's not really the case. It just, you know, where she just kind of glanced up a little bit, but it wasn't toward the viewer or the camera, which is because it's a point of view shot. It, you know, and so she is genuinely caught by surprise when she hears the voices outside. And of course, I mean, obviously she's shattered because A, the accusation, and B, oh my gosh, how long have these people been staring at me?
Right. Now, that's not the only love story that Nair juggles here so well. There's also Aditi and Hemant, but there's also Aisha and Rahul. Aisha is played by Neha Dubey, and Rahul is played by Radeep Huda. And their relationship is pretty fun and sexy and knowing. And that fits in well with the tone of the movie. And that brings me to the part I was getting back to about the Indian influences, which Claude mentioned briefly in his synopsis. What Nair said that she wanted to do when making this movie was make a Bollywood movie, except she wanted to shoot it like a documentary. Now, for those of you who are not familiar, Bollywood is arguably the most successful worldwide film industry. It's also known as Bollywood movies are also known as masala movies. And masala is a mixture, and it brings together, it's a mixture of, masala is a mixture of spices in Indian cuisine, and a masala movie is a mixture of all kinds of genres, including action, comedy, romance, drama or melodrama, and musicals. And a lot of the musical numbers are filmed either in or against picturesque locations, whether they're using a rear view screening or green screens. They may have graduated to that. I'm not, unfortunately, terribly familiar with Bollywood movies. My first exposure to them actually was in that Buffy the Vampire Slayer episode Reptile Boy, which starts out with Buffy, Willow, and Xander watching a Bollywood movie and has Buffy's memorable line in reaction. So how does the water buffalo fit in again? But I have since then seen a couple Bollywood movies, including arguably the one that was the most successful financially in the West, Lagan, which was nominated for what used to be known as Best Foreign Language Film at the Oscars and is now Best Non-English Language Movie, which is a nearly four-hour masala or Bollywood movie about a lengthy cricket match, if you can believe it. It is pretty entertaining, even though it does fulfill a lot of the cliches of the sports movie And some of those cliches deserve to have gone by the wayside. And it also gilds the lily a little too much at the end. But overall, it is entertaining. However, I do prefer what Nair did with Monsoon Wedding in that regard. For starters, she and Declan Quinn, who was the cinematographer, they use handheld camera work here throughout the movie, except for one scene involving Alice, which was shot in a classical style. And you have documentary-like footage of New Delhi going on throughout the movie, showing us how the other half lives. Because even though Lalit may be struggling to pay for this wedding, he's still well off compared to others.
Oh, yeah.
As are people like Vikram and Tash as well. And the musical numbers that are in the movie, they are not set against exotic locations. They're shot on location with that handheld camera work. And whereas in Lagan, it seemed like all the singing was done by one man and one female, and all the actors are lip-syncing to just one voice, one male voice or one female voice. Here, you do get a lot of different voices, even though there is quite a lot of recorded music in this movie as well. But all of the songs are compelling, and all of the dance scenes are compelling, especially in the night before the wedding, when Aisha is getting up and dancing in front of everybody, and Rahu finally takes the step and decides to dance with her. And even the dancing that's done during the wedding, which, by the way, I don't know if you mentioned this in the synopsis, but yes, a giant rainstorm does take place during the wedding, a monsoon, hence the title, Monsoon Wedding.
Yeah, I was like, I was watching, and my daughter had come in during the film and sat down and watched the ending with me. And I was like, you know, so far, we're like in the last 20 minutes of the film. And she said, how is it? And I said, well, so far, ain't been no monsoon, ain't been no wedding. And then we get to the ending and she's like, well, there's your monsoon. I was like, yeah, well, it's raining, but you know, but I get it. It's a season and it's got to, you know, make its way in. But yes, it does. I did mention that the rains did come.
Okay. But anyway, so instead of having either an epic sweep like Lagan does in filming all these scenes, or a more classical period, like the classical type of filmmaking, like the excerpts of Bollywood movies that I've seen, you have this handheld camera work, these improvisational scenes, and these documentary type footage of New Delhi. And it all works together pretty seamlessly, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, one of the hallmarks of Bollywood, like that I think most Americans think of as a typical Bollywood movie, there's an elaborate dance number that just seems to appear out of nowhere, and that just seems to be like kind of expected apparently by the audiences. But before I want to come back to this in a sec, I just want to ask you, because of the ending specifically of Slumdog Millionaire, would you consider that a Bollywood film because of the out of blue dance scene on the down? It was a train platform, wasn't it?
Yes. And I would say that it's done in the spirit of Bollywood movies. I haven't seen enough Bollywood movies to say whether or not that's definitively be called a Bollywood movie, but certainly Danny Boyle was trying to conjure up the spirit of those type of movies.
Yeah. All right. So let me come back to this, because this is kind of interesting as we're talking about, like, you know, it's got a Bollywood feel and at the same time it's got a documentary feel. And I think that's one of the things that kind of draws me into this story, is that you're having a lot of tradition taking place here, in that there's an arranged marriage and that certain things have to happen at a certain day and a certain time, and somebody has to dance and da-da-da-da-da, and we're going to have a dance scene, right? That sort of thing. And at the same time, there are a lot of modern touches that are going on here. And, you know, there is the mention of, like, you know, Y2K and 2001 and that sort of thing. And so the fact that the bride and groom, you know, it's not one of these things where they've only known each other for a half hour before they get married. It's been a few weeks between their introduction and the wedding itself. And so that's something, and that they're spending time on their own as a couple away from the families, which is, as I understand it, not especially typical. So they're doing some of the old stuff and they're doing some of the new stuff, and it's kind of fun to see, because even as some of the younger people are resisting some of the older stuff, they can't help but get sucked into some of the traditional stuff too, as in some of these scenes where people are just sitting around and one person starts singing and everybody's joining in. And there's one scene in particular where it's mostly women, but Varun is in the scene too, and they start singing this. One of the women starts singing the song and the others start joining in. And it's kind of a call and response song about who am I going to marry? And, oh, well, he's going to marry the fat girl. And no, the fat girl's going to take up too much of the bed, or whatever it was that the thrust of the song was. It was like this, like, semi-body kind of tune. And I was like, this is kind of, I wish I knew the words so I could sing along, because it does kind of, it's an extended kind of scene. It's several minutes long. And I'm like, this is kind of cool. I don't understand a word they're saying except for captions, but this is fun. I would like to sing along with this. And I know nothing about this culture. And so I think Nair did a nice job of integrating the two, where the past is meeting the future and things are definitely changing, but we still tend to look back at things. And that's also really what we get in this story. Well, like the relationship between Lalit and Tej's uncle is because he feels responsible for something that happened many, many years ago. And, well, I can't cut him loose now because he did this thing. It was like years and years ago, and maybe even when Lalit was a small child, but there's still responsibility there. So it probably wasn't even Tej. It was might've been like Tej's dad who really did this for the family.
And at the same time, it's making clear that there are things that do need to change. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that Varun, for example, because he's seen by his father as not being masculine enough, but the movie makes it clear that, you know, that's the way it is for him, that he's going to be like he is, and his father does have to accept that. But
right, I don't think we really get a full resolution on that particular story angle.
No, but the implication is there.
Yeah.
I want to get back to what you mentioned here about the song, that it's being semi-body. That is one other change that Nair wanted to bring with this movie, or one other thing that she wanted to do that was somewhat differently from Bollywood movies. Now, we have to be fair here. I don't know if it's true anymore, but censorship guidelines in India used to be very strict. And that meant talking about romance, or showing romance on screen. Even in Lagan, you know, there is a romance between the main character and the woman who's loved him since she was a child. And then there's a British woman who falls in love with him, the main character as well. But all of that is very discreet and is only played out in the singing, where they express their feelings for each other. As I said, India, censorship restrictions in India at the time were very strict. Not only what you could show, but what you could talk about. There's another Indian, female Indian filmmaker, Indian Canadian filmmaker in this case, Deepa Mehta, who made a trio of movies concerning the elements and also concerning the plight of Indian women, one of which was Water, which was nominated for Best Foreign Film at the Oscars the same year as After the Wedding was. And Indian censors were so outraged at what that film was about, which is a lesbian relationship, that they actively interfered with the making of that movie, including doing some property damage and even death threats, I think, to some of the people involved. And the point that I'm coming around to is that Nair in Monsoon Wedding, she's not shying away from showing sex or romance on screen or talking about even the darker implications of a sexual relationship with a revelation about what Tej has been doing and what she did in the past, what he did in the past, excuse me. And so that this is a movie that, while it does have that very chaste courtship between PK and Alice, everywhere else, Nair is quite frank about depicting sexuality and talking about sexuality on screen. And I think the movie is all the better for it.
Yeah, it actually, now that I think about it, it reminds me a little bit of the wedding scene from The Godfather, where at one point you've got the older generation people, they're singing Que la Luna, and which is basically a song that, and they're singing it in Italian. And at one point you can see where there's the old guy who comes out and he starts to sing and he's gesturing and it's just like everybody is cracking up. And you can see that some of them are actually a little bit scandalized by what he is singing. And the thrust of that song is basically, don't marry a musician because you'll see him at some point with an instrument in his hand. It's like, not quite spelled out what's going on, but this guy's going to do those hand gestures and make you understand exactly what instrument that is.
Yes. Now, speaking of the music, one last thing I want to bring up before we wrap this up. One of the musicians who is featured in the soundtrack for this movie, in addition to a composer who we talked about in our previous episode, Michael Dana, who wrote the score to Exotica and who produced a couple of these songs, there's a traditional song that's performed here called the Alahu, and it was arranged by a Pakistani musician by the name of Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. Now, he's a singer-songwriter, and he's probably best known in the U.S. anyway for his collaborations with artists such as Peter Gabriel and Eddie Vedder. If you ever saw Dead Man Walking or heard two songs that played, one over the opening credits, the other over the closing credits, those are a duet between Khan and Eddie Vedder. Mm-hmm. And he does a song for, or arranged a song for the soundtrack here. But all of the music, including the song that you mentioned, that the women are all singing at one point, is entertaining, even if, like myself and Claude, you don't understand the words at all. So do you have anything else that you want to add to this before we wrap this up, Claude?
No, this is fun. This is a fun, fun film, despite the rather dark revelation that we get near the end. It's really very enjoyable. And if you haven't seen it already and you've been spoiled by everything we told you, well, go see it anyway.
Exactly. So stay tuned for part two, where we talk about After the Wedding.
Yeah, that's coming up immediately in your podcast feed, so stick around.